Welcome to American Theater's Off-Script Podcast. This is our revamp. We've done this a couple times before, but now we're doing it for reals.
Well, I wouldn't say it's for real, but I guess we're officializing it.
Yeah, it's probably going to be bi-weekly. So I'm here with, introduce ourselves.
I'm Susie Evans, I'm the managing editor, and it's my first time on the podcast, so it's new for me.
And I'm Deek Tran, I'm the assistant editor. I think I've done this a couple times, and I stopped doing it because I don't like the sound of my own voice.
All right, well, leave others to judge that. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm the senior editor at American Theater Magazine. And it's an exciting week. We are putting out our October issue, which is our big, giant season preview issue. It's also the week that we look forward to the season, but we also look forward to which plays are going to be the top 10 most produced plays. This year, it's the top 11 because of a tie. And since Deep put this together, you can do the honors. Do you want to just read through quickly the top 10 list?
Okay, top 10. At number 10 is, actually, number 11 is Venus in Fur by David Ives with six productions.
That was last year's top number one. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. I guess everyone got really tired of S&M gear and...
Well, it's still making the top 11, though.
And second on the list is Into the Woods with six productions as well. I think it may have something to do with the film coming out later this season.
It's possible. It's interesting, though. People, August Osage County, people thought it would be done a lot after the movie, but there's like three productions next season. But anyway, go on.
Didn't it already have its moment like a couple years ago?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that movie didn't do super well either, so.
Next is 4,000 Miles, which is my personal favorite. By Amy Herzog.
Yeah, with how many persons? Six?
Six, yeah.
So we're going up the list here.
Yes, we're going up the list. Yeah, kind of like David Letterman.
Yeah, sure, right. Yeah. Just like that.
That was on the list last year, too, 4,000 Miles.
That's been on for a while, yeah.
And Tribes by Nina Raine, the next one, with at seven productions. And next is The Whipping Man by Matthew Lopez, also with seven. He's been on here for a while. This is his third year on the list in a row.
Popular show.
And next on the list at number six is Peter and the Starcatcher by Rick Ellis at seven productions.
Great.
Which I didn't see that on Broadway, but I heard it was good. And next is Around the World in 80 Days, which with seven productions, six productions for the Mark Brown adaptation and one for the Toby Hulse adaptation.
Right.
Important. I don't really know what's going on with that play, but...
Well, that's been around for a while. It's a bit like 39 Steps. It's very modular, like you can stage all this magic stuff with just a few pieces, so I think it's popular for that.
Oh, yeah. It's just odd that's coming up again.
It was just in New York like a year ago and had a pretty big production, so.
That's true.
We are the center of the universe. Just joking, guys. Don't be upset. Number four is Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates. And this is also his third year on the list.
Wow. Eight productions?
Eight productions.
The first year on the list is...
And Bad Jews by Joshua Harmon.
Which we published in our magazine in the April issue?
Yeah, look it up.
it's on the website. Just search Joshua Harmon.
Eight productions, and now we're getting to the last two. What's our number two most produced play?
Number two is Outside Mullingar by John Patrick Shanley.
All right.
Did anyone see that?
I did see it.
I quite enjoyed it, actually.
I just wonder how many of those productions were set up before it even premiered on Broadway.
John Patrick Shanley puts out a new comedy. People are going to be all over it.
And at number one is... Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike by the always entertaining Chris Durang at 27 productions.
27 productions. Now, last year it was on the list. It was down the middle of the list. But I found that when I looked back at the season, we always report these top 10 lists before the season and what people tell us they're going to do. If you look back at the season, it was actually like higher than we initially reported in October. So it was like number two last season if you went and retroactively corrected the top 10 list. Just a little bit of data to throw in there.
We have lots of data here at TCG.
Quickly, before we go into those exciting features with the critics and with Chris Durang, talking about Vanya and Sonia, talk about what we're looking forward to. We print this giant issue of what the season's offerings are going to be.
150 pages worth of
150
stuff.
Pages, 404 member theaters, TCG member theaters, with 1,876 entries. That's a lot of plays. So in going through those and then just looking at our own inbox, what are the things we're looking forward to in the coming season? Deep?
I guess anything at the Public Theater.
Yeah, the Public has a particularly strong season coming up.
But I feel like that goes without saying at this point.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, they've had seasons that were less amazing than this. This is a season where I don't think
It's not a dud among them.
Yeah, that we're looking forward to. Who knows what they'll be like, but it looks like an amazing season, right? So for Straight White Men, Hamilton,
yeah, exactly.
Fortress of Solitude, the Bridget Everett thing going on right now. What else? There's a couple others, right?
The new Susan Laurie Parks play,
oh, right,
My Father Comes Home.
And that's in three parts or something,
yes.
Right? Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Susie?
I'm really looking forward. I just got booked flights to go out to San Diego to see Bright Star at the Old Globe. I'm really looking forward to seeing
Bright Star?
Bright Star is a new musical with music by Steve Martin and Edie Brickell. It's based on their Grammy-winning album Together. Rob probably knows a little bit more about it than
I
do.
I'm writing a story for the November issue, although we'll probably put it up online early since the show is in previews now, actually. It's gonna get reviews pretty soon.
Yeah, I'm looking for that. I'm also trying to make a trip out to Chicago to see the Hypocrites, Gilbert and Sullivan, in Rep.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah,
so I'm really looking forward to that out in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, speaking of Chicago, like the Francis Yachiu Kowhake play, The World of Extreme Happiness, is playing at the Goodman. It's coming to MTC.
And it's featured on an October cover.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know it's coming to MTC. That's great. I am interested in a Sheila Callahan play that was at the Boston Court in Pasadena, Theater at Boston Court, that Jessica Kubzanski directed. She's an amazing director who's really only known in L.A. because she's directed there for so long. It's a Sheila Callahan play. Sheila Callahan, we all know, has done a lot of downtown theater. And she's got a play actually coming up at Yale Rep, Elevada. But she's been, you know, lured out to Hollywood to work on TV shows like Shameless. But this show called Everything You Touch is going to be at the Rattlestick. I don't think they've announced an official date yet. And it's not going to be the same cast, but it's the same design team. And it's a piece that sounds a little sort of stoppery, two time periods. It's about fashion and makeovers. The design looks amazing. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also very excited about the way the Rattlestick seems to be making relationships with L.A. theaters, because there's a lot of great L.A. theaters. L.A. was where I was for a long time, so I keep an eye on their doings.
Yeah, aren't we all from L.A.? I mean, we're in L.A.
The West Coast, yeah.
Yeah, all three of us are from the West Coast.
But you're from the Bay Area, right?
I'm from the Bay Area, but I went to UCLA.
Yeah.
And you're from Orange County, technically.
But I went to UCLA as well. And
fun fact, Susie hired Deep as an intern at the UCLA Daily Bruin back in 2007.
So if you don't like me,
blame me.
It's Susie's fault.
I went to USC, so we will just pass over that in silence. I think without further ado, we're going to go into our featured interview with Chris Durang. So stay tuned. We'll come back at the end of the show and give our recommendations of things to see, read, watch, think about. Stay tuned. Season's most produced play will be Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. It's Christopher Durang's comedy about middle-aged siblings and their home in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. We spoke with Mr. Durang over a Skype connection from his home in Bucks County about his play, about lines he didn't include in the play, and about its surprising success.
Hi there.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Thanks so much for taking the time. I guess I could start off by saying congratulations that it will be the most produced play at TCG member theaters next season. Last year it was Venus and Fur. The year before it was Good People. So you're in good company. Last year it was very, very much produced. In fact, this is maybe too arcane, but we do our top 10 list at the beginning of the season when people tell us what they're going to produce. We went back and looked at what was produced last season, and Vanya and Sonia actually was like number two or something last. If you looked at the end of the season, some people suddenly stuck it on their season. I think Center Stage in Baltimore. Other people just didn't tell us they were planning to do it back last October. So, I want to just talk a little about the play. It was a disarming and a play to me. I guess I expected when I heard the title that it was going to be a parody, because you've done For Whom the Southern Bell Tolls and it's not a parody. Could you talk a little bit about how you came up with the Chekhovian frame and then Did you expect it to be more parodic, or was it?
No, I didn't. I was definitely not writing a parody, but I was a little worried that people would think that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the things I said to early interviews about it, starting in McCarter, was that it was not a parody. I took some themes and characters from different plays and put them into a blender, which is different than a parody. And then also it's set in the present, it's set in America. And I remember I was very happy when writing, when early on I decided that Vanya and Sonia and Masha had professor parents who had named them after Chekhov plays, which I hoped would also let people know that it wasn't a parody, that they weren't really Vanya and Sonia. And indeed, Masha, the actress is really much closer to Madame Arkadna, but I didn't want the title to be Vanya and Sonia and Madame Arkadna.
Yeah, and of course, they're characters who are self-aware that they're they know the Chekhov plays, they know the literature, and they are also self-aware of the ways in which they resemble and don't resemble the, right. the characters they're based on. Are you a big Chekhov fan? Was there homage intended, if not parody?
I am a big Chekhov fan.
Sure.
Starting in college and into the rest of my 20s and early 30s, I wasn't literally thinking of homage. What triggered me was, I don't know, out of the blue, sometime in my late 50s, I went, oh my God, I'm now the age of the old people in Chekhov, because I had seen it in college, read them in college and seen them through my 20s. And I've always been a young man looking at Chekhov.
Right.
So that was surprise number one. And then the other thing, this isn't a surprise per se, but with my partner, now husband, John Augustine, we moved out to the country in Bucks County.
Right.
But I have lived for 22 years in New York. But living out here, I live in a farmhouse on a hill. I started to remember how in some of the Chekhov plays, the people who live in the country are unhappy because they never got to do anything with their lives, while Madame Arkadna is off in the cities and is as well known as an actress, and the professor from Uncle Vanya is a lecturer and has a beautiful wife, and Vanya is so jealous of him. And so I thought the setting of my house reminded me of those two plays in particular.
Right, okay.
And so I started to write something, and I thought, well, what if I, you know, hadn't followed trying to be what I wanted to work in theater, and what if I hadn't, you know, lived in New York for a long time and actually wanted to come out to the country? I do think they've been to college, so I sort of envisioned that they went to college, but at some point they came back, and so it became very much a what if play.
Right. It's because you did accomplish something and move to the country, sort of lived that dream, which is the reverse, I suppose, of what the Chekhov characters. Maybe that accounts for the play seems very warm, and I'm not saying none of your plays have ever been had a warm feeling to them, but it ends on a almost, I wouldn't say defiantly, but it ends on a un-Chekhovian tone of, you know, we're going to be okay, kind of. And I wonder if that accounts for you. It's a what-if exercise to see about these people who are thwarted. But then you're a fairly, I mean, would be fair to say you are where you want to be. You're not, you don't have huge regrets. You're not a bitter person. Or maybe I'm putting thoughts into your head.
No, I agree with everything you said.
Okay.
You know, I can have my grouchy days, but I guess I don't really, I feel lucky. In terms of, I've been a playwright a long time. Most of my plays have not gone to, they've gone to nonprofit theaters normally. So from time to time, I've been sorry that I haven't been on Broadway. I had sort of stopped thinking about that. And the fact that this moved to Broadway and was so successful was this enormous surprise to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Also, I'm not good at outline and knowing what the end is going to be, but I surprised myself that so much sort of came together in a warm way, as mm-hmm. you say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice surprise for me.
Well, yeah, it feels like it's a nice surprise for the audience as well, in a good way. I think, you know, especially people talk about Sonia's, the scene with the phone call where she is going to have a second date. But it doesn't feel unearned. I wanted to focus on one other aspect, was the speech, the big rant that Vanya has against Spike. It got a huge round of applause. I saw it twice on Broadway, and then I've talked to some critics in other towns. It gets a big round of applause. Did it get a big round of applause when you played it in Bucks County as well?
Yeah, it did also get applause. Yeah, most of the time I've seen it get applause.
I just wanted, without interrogating the speech too much, it's a more conflicted speech, I think, than people give it credit for. It does feel like this is what Chris Turang thinks about the modern era, and we're all us boomers in the audience are applauding, and yeah, those kids with their technology. I mean, is it fair to say the speech is maybe a little more ambivalent than that? And also, did you also put a little bit of your, as you say, your grouchy self in there, like these damn kids?
Yes, I mean, well, you know, it starts frankly with Spike being insensitive and texting in a very small room where someone is putting on a play.
Right.
So it's really, you know, and I think for the first part of the play, Vanya is slightly intrigued by Spike. I mean, he doesn't think he's really coming on for real, but it's sort of interesting for him. And I loved how David Hyde Pierce played that. But it was firstly just about a kind of rudeness. But then I there's no question that I every generation must look back to childhood and everything. But I like email. And ever since people have seen that play, they're always sending me handwritten letters because Vanya suggests that somebody, you know, Spike has never done that. And it's true. I did used to write letters more when I was, you know, in my 40s and younger, but I love the quickness of email, and I also procrastinate, and actually getting a stamp in an envelope can take me 2 weeks or 2 months. So I feel very guilty about these people who send me lovely things by letter.
That's
really Vanya saying that. But I feel that now it is, I don't have children, but when I watch television and, see the shocking and sexual things you can see, I just, to be truthful, I was glad I didn't see all those things when I was 13 and 10 and so on.
Right.
And that's really does sound like a conservative position, but I guess it's, I'm grateful I didn't know what pussy galore meant when
right.
I watched it. When I was 13. I mean, that.
That's a funny line, yeah.
Yeah. Or as I said, I had a talk back at the Bucks County Playhouse that was a nice one, but somebody asked me it was a young person asking about the monologue and what it meant and why I was angry at younger people was sort of the implication, because I don't think I'm angry about it, but I just see differences. And the line I came up with, which wasn't in the play, but, you know, I'm glad that as a child I didn't have to see on the television when they would say, and see your doctor if you have an erection for longer than 4 hours. It's kind of like, you know, why must that be on television? It just... I don't know. So I, I guess, and then this is something that people do when they're older, but I liked, in retrospect, being somewhat, not knowing as much about adult things, learning them later on.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I think back on this speech, I reread it, but when I thought back on it, I felt, yeah, there was this nostalgia thing that seemed to get the audience applauding. But then I remember there's this whole thing about Tommy Kirk and how he was mistreated and how bitter Vanya is about that. And it feels like, well, that's fairly ambivalent because in those days, being closeted was not a picnic.
Yeah, it is. In a way, early on, Vanya in the speech says, I know older people always think the past is better. And I do think that that's true. And you know, if one were to compare now to then, and,
yeah,
you know, there would be pluses and minuses of in both.
Great. I wonder if I could ask you, what did you discover about your play that maybe you didn't know when you had to play in it, when you acted as Vanya? Was that a last minute replacement? I can't remember the story exactly. You weren't intended, but you stepped into the cast. Is that right?
No. You know, it started at McCarter, then it went to Lincoln Center and Broadway.
That's right,
and,
sure.
And then it was done in Philadelphia. And so, to my surprise, Bucks County Playhouse, which is not super close to it, was somewhat close to Philadelphia. Anyway, they asked if they could do the play. And I said, sure. And then a couple of weeks later, they asked if I would like to play Vanya.
Right.
And I have done acting in the past, and I thought, I'm the right age, and also, I enjoyed listening to the laughter of the play, so I thought, oh, well, maybe this would be fun. And to be honest, it wasn't fun. But let me put it another way. It's really
sure.
Hard work.
Hard work, yeah.
It was only 2 weeks rehearsal, which I knew, but it's really short for that summer stock time. And it only ran for 3 weeks, and the second 2 weeks, I did have fun, and because I started to feel safer and remembering everything better, but the first week was nerve-wracking. I found that there would be certain lines I would not remember, and then I'd have to come up with something.
Oh, wow.
A, it's my age, and B, I most professional productions are, 3 weeks.
Sure.
And this is just 2 weeks. So the first week of performances was like the third week of rehearsal.
Right, right, right. Your play is now being done in at least three theaters that we know of. Arizona Theater Company just opened a production, and it's in both Carolinas, North Carolina at Playmakers in Chapel Hill and South Carolina at Trustus in Columbia, South Carolina. It's going to be done, as we know, like 20 odd places more this season. And I wondered, maybe pivoting off what I just asked, if there were things you learned about the play and maybe notes you would give if you were going to give a first day rehearsal speech to other companies doing your show, what would you say what you learned about your own play?
I probably learned some things. Among the other things, it's much longer than the plays I was in when I was younger. Laughing Wild was 90 minutes. Marriage of Bette and Boo was like an hour. I can't remember how old it was, but it was under 2 hours.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And also, Vanya is on stage, which is for Act One, nonstop for an hour and 10 minutes. And I remember the one performance where I do not know why, but I got a little lightheaded, and I thought, I can't leave the stage for 40 more minutes. I just have to will this away, which went away. It was all right, but
right.
But then other things I discovered, which was just my own. Well, I partially knew this from writing it. When I was writing the play, I thought that Vanya and Sonia were both going to be incredibly bitter all the time. At least that was their starting off point. But as I wrote it, Vanya kept being a bit of a peacemaker, especially when Masha showed up.
Right.
And that's not actually in Chekhov. I can't off the top of my head think of anybody who's a peacemaker in Chekhov. Are there any?
But well, Sonya maybe a little bit. Yeah, go on. Sorry. Not really.
Well, definitely not Vanya.
No.
And also my Sonya is not really like too much the Sonya of the real Uncle Vanya. First of all, she's a niece and that she's in love with the doctor. And I thought there was going to be more about unrequited love, and there wasn't, as I wrote it. But in any case, acting in it, I was surprised how much in my acting choices I was worried for Sonya after that opening scene where they're mad at each other about the coffee and everything. But when Masha shows up, I just found myself that all the so much of what he says is protective of her. And I found that interesting to have to play it because it made it more clear that that was in there.
Right. So, yeah, I guess in closing, just what would you say to companies doing your show? Do you make a habit of seeing your shows in other productions, or you try to stay away from that?
I don't love to travel, to be honest.
Okay,
so
right.
I don't see lots of them, but I do go to some, and I just for what it's worth, I just had a conversation this morning with the director of the Don Stevenson, who's going to direct it at Paper Mill Playhouse.
Okay.
And I had actually reached out to them because that's where I grew up. The first theater I saw was at Paper Mill Playhouse. I saw many musicals there, and I still have an aunt and cousins who live in that area. So I just sort of, to this person, I was talking about things I had learned from auditions, because sometimes you learn in auditions things that go wrong.
Yeah.
And then other little quirks that might have happened to some of the productions I did go see to. And I talked a lot about Cassandra, actually, because when I was writing it, the actress who did it originally, Shalita Grant, who got a Tony nomination, and she's quite wonderful. She was in the first reading at Manhattan Theater Club, and she kind of got it right away. So I never had to tell her much. But I've since seen, so I didn't really give the best stage directions for her, because sometimes I don't mean to go on and on and on about
right.
them, but... But for instance, she is a real person. You can't just make Greek tragedy sounds all the time.
Right.
And you also have to know what you're saying, even though the Greek tragedy stuff is very arcane. And then the other thing is, when I was writing it, I feel that she is a real psychic. Sometimes she's wrong, sometimes she's right. But Lord knows when she says out of the blue, beware of Hootie Pie, turns out to be really true.
Yeah.
But when she has these strange speeches, I realize that you can't really play it if you're playing, I'm making these words up as I'm saying them. It becomes too calculated,
okay.
I think. So to me, she's channeling something. But I've never put the word channeling in there.
Okay.
So I see that in auditions that people sometimes come in and just haven't a clue how to do the role.
Yeah, I think I'll just close by asking, Hootie Pie, where did that come from?
It didn't come from anywhere particularly. I wanted, you know, first she comes, she says a few psychic things that you can make sense out of, and then she says, I wanted it to be something totally baffling.
Yeah.
So I just came up with the word Hootie Pie. I don't know, based on absolutely nothing. And not only that, but I have to, this is, again, since I don't always know where my play is going, when I brought it up, I didn't know who Hootie Pie was.
Okay.
I had no idea what she was talking about, but I figured at some point I must figure this out. And then when Masha came in and she said Hootie Pie made the costumes, I thought, oh, okay, she works for Masha.
Right.
And initially that was going to be the problem. And I was originally going to have Spike meet someone at the party and like go off with a real estate person.
Okay.
And then somewhere along the line, I changed my mind and it's Hootie Pie he goes off with. So
Chris, it's been a true pleasure to talk to you about your show, and I wish it all the best, and enjoy the royalty checks, I guess.
Yes, indeed.
All right, sir. Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay.
Okay.
Nice to see you.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye now.
Next on the podcast, we talk to three critics from around the country who've seen Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike.
So welcome and thanks for joining us this afternoon. This is one of our first Critics Roundtables. We did one for the Humana Festival plays. But we thought people talk about how theater is not part of the national conversation anymore. But, of course, there are a number of plays that are done all over the country, especially when they're new and popular. And we published a top 10 playlist of plays that we produced in the coming season. And the most produced play of the coming season is Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. It was one of the most produced last season as well. Playing, actually, a bunch of productions are opening this coming month and this coming season. But we thought we'd get one representative that recently opened. So why don't we start by introducing ourselves, the critics who've joined us from around the country. I'll start with you, August, since you're the most recent. Introduce yourself. Tell me who you write for and when you saw the play.
I'm August Crickle. I'm the theater editor for Jasper Magazine. I also write for the Free Times and On Stage Columbia here in Columbia, South Carolina. I just saw the play last Friday night, opening night of the 30th season of Trustus Theater.
Great, great. And Jim, this is going in order of who saw it the most recently, I think. Introduce yourself and tell us when you saw it.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jim Hebert. I'm the theater critic for the UT San Diego, the Daily here in town. And I saw the play on Broadway in 2013, and then most recently in May of this year at the Old Globe in San Diego.
Great. And then finally, Wendy.
Yeah, I'm Wendy Rosenfield, and I review for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I write a column on theater criticism for the Broad Street Review, and I saw it this past spring at Philadelphia Theater Company in March.
Okay, great. Great. And I saw it on Broadway as well. But I'm not really in the critical discussion. I will try to guide it. I wanted to start with a summary of the sort of premise, some of the characters. I don't need a plot summary. I will start with you, Jim, if you feel up to it. Tell us, basically, when someone asks you, what's this play about? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah, sure. It's very loosely based on themes and characters from Chekhov. But you don't really need to, have a deep background in that to be able to appreciate the play, I don't think. But it's essentially a family comedy having to do with siblings, two of whom are still living in their parents' home, their childhood home. One of whom is a big Hollywood star, and comes back to town and creates all sorts of turmoil. I think that's the overview. It's a funny play because, and I know we'll go into this more, but it's kind of a farce, but the tone of it is different from what you're used to seeing in a farce. So interesting piece of work.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's worth mentioning that the title characters they're named after by their late parents. They're named after various favorite Chekhov characters. And, amusingly take on various characteristics of those characters in their lives, or reflect those characters' sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess. And then the Spike, who's obviously not at all a Chekhov character, is the boyfriend of the Hollywood star Masha, who comes back to see the house. And then in an echo of Vanya, of course, threatens to sell the house. But
yeah, and there's even a Nina who shows up, not in the title, but in the play.
That's so. Right. That's right. That's right.
And also, I'll just add.
Spike will end up in a lost Chekhov play.
Yeah, right.
I'll also add that there's a Cassandra character, and I think it's interesting that she was left out, and we can talk about that later.
I mean, in the description, yeah, it's interesting. She is a Cassandra character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Literally. So I wanted to go around and then I'll start with you again, Jim, since you were just talking. What did you think of this play? Did it work? You said it was a farce, but it had a different tone than a farce.
Yeah.
And those farces.
I thought that was one of the interesting things about it was that to me it sort of defies type a little bit. You know, it's sometimes described, I think, as a farce, and yet it has a pretty dry tone, and that's, you know, right, obviously in line with Christopher Durang's work. But I think it sort of took a lot of people by surprise. I really enjoyed it. I'm curious to know what the others thought based on the productions they saw, because both of the productions I saw were essentially Nicky Martin's productions. He was the Broadway director. He also was scheduled to be the director at the Old Globe, and then he took ill, and Jessica Stone, who is a protege of his, took over. But as she described it to me anyway, she was essentially recreating his direction, his Broadway direction, and he very sadly passed away just about 2 weeks before the Old Globe production. Right. So anyway, yeah, so I, you know, based on the productions that I saw, that was my take on it. I really enjoyed it as something that is not, you know, not really comparable to other shows I've seen.
Of Durang's or just in general?
Yeah, I think in general, just because I think it's a tricky thing to do something that in some ways, you know, if you read it on the page, I think it's, you know, comes off as so kind of outlandish. And yet it's the way it's played is so much more dry and just, you know, almost there's a weird almost realism to it that sort of is like in counterpoint to the quality of the writing, which I found really interesting.
Huh, interesting. Wendy, it sounded like you were eager to jump in.
Well, I wasn't exactly a fan of this show. I had several reasons for it. You know, I've seen a few Durang shows here in Philly, and I'll tell you, I enjoyed it for its family relationships, but the Cassandra character really got under my skin for a number of reasons, and I'm not sure that I bought the whole Spike edition. Nina was okay. I was fine with Nina, but I just felt that it sort of lost its way, and I don't know. It's the kind of show. It's not the reason. The kind of show that's not the reason that I go to theater. I go to theater to sort of expand my horizons, and I felt that this production sort of that its job was to sort of reassure everyone or reassure its audience of everything they already believed.
August, I wonder if you wanted to chime in.
Enjoyed it. I thought it was a very funny show, both the material and then the production that I saw. I agree that it's hard to put it into a particular category or to describe it. If you say that it's based on Chekhov, you're going to confuse people. You really don't need to know anything about Chekhov. You could say it's a parody of Chekhov, but it's not exactly a parody. A Saturday Night Live sketch for 5 minutes would be a parody. This was a real play. The plot works by itself. The characters interact their story. You follow their story and want to know what happens to them. So without even getting many of the things that are being satirized or parodied or pastiche, you can still follow the plot and enjoy the humor just because there are a lot of funny lines in the show.
Sure, sure. I think what surprised me was, you know, Durang did write a parody for Whom the Southern Bell mm-hmm. Tolls, which is a parody of Glass Menagerie and a couple other Tennessee Williams plays mashed together. And that's a straight-up parody, which you will appreciate a lot more if you know the Tennessee Williams plays. This one I thought was going to be that, and of course it's not that at all. It has a few lines, but the characters are self-aware. They know they've been named after Chekhov plays, and they know that they're sort of living in the absurdity of that. So when they quote lines from the play or a scene starts to look to resemble a Chekhov play, they're self-aware. The thing you said, Wendy, was interesting. Was, you know, there's that big speech that Vanya has in the second act.
Right.
I don't know if that, on Broadway, that got a lot of applause, the one about, we used to lick postage stamps, mm-hmm. In which Vanya has this, you know, sort of breakdown rant, the way David Hyde Pierce did it, at least. and it got thunderous applause. And I'm not sure. I need to ask Chris Durang if he intended it to get applause. If that's expressing his views. I wondered if that's what you're talking about, Wendy, when you say it's reassuring people to sort of looking back on Ed Sullivan and the way things used to be and no texting and all that.
Yeah, I mean, we're clearly supposed to identify with Vanya. He's the most sympathetic character. And, you know, I know people who really appreciated the licking stamps monologue. You know, we used to lick stamps. But I just found it, I actually resent those assertions a bit. I appreciate that beautiful things have been lost in the past, things that took time, but we also had segregation and women were girls or young wives or overbearing mothers-in-law or invisible on all the television shows that, he discusses. And I felt that this play is very disdainful of people of color and young people, and don't get me wrong, I think there are really beautiful moments and hilarious moments in the show as well, but underlying it all, the message that I took away from it was that it was disdainful of people of color and young people. And the message was that we don't want them at our shows, but if they do come, it will be clear that they're not welcome to participate as our equals. You could make an argument that the Neonic character is fighting that a bit, but I don't know. That monologue really bothered me. I didn't agree with most of what he said. And and of course he's a man who's being left in the dust, and he realizes it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we are supposed to identify with him, and that's what bothered me.
Yeah. Well, Chris Durang actually played the part in Bucks County at some point.
Yes, he did. He did.
Slightly different take on that monologue.
Yeah.
Vanya got a spontaneous round of applause when I saw it as well, primarily just because the actor had managed to do a 10-minute monologue and choke on a single line. And the audience really, really admired that. Our Vanya did it in a very low-key manner. The reviews I've read of the Broadway production, he's a little bit more impassioned. I'm not sure whether we as an audience, or even we as baby boomers, are supposed to identify with him or not. The impression I got was that both Vanya and Sonia, they're suffering from this malaise. Their souls are sort of decaying. She has a more specific reason. She realizes she's unmarried. She realizes life has passed her by. He seems more content, or at least accepting of his fate. He seems to be happy to get up every morning, drink his coffee, look and watch for the birds outside. But late in the second act, he sort of gives a much more subtle, much broader malaise that has been affecting him and many people of his generation for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I was not a big fan. I'll have to say that monologue was not one of my favorite parts of the show. And I kind of felt as though it was almost like pandering on Durang's part, because it almost felt sort of calibrated to get that kind of applause that it did get. So I actually, I think that Sonia, it was interesting to hear what Wendy had to say, and I think I understand the point she's making. I thought Sonia was a pretty sympathetic character, actually, and in the production that I saw at the Globe, she actually got a round of applause at the point where she sort of asserts herself when she's on the phone and decides to, go have a, I think she's going to go have a second date with this guy that she met at the party. It was kind of a sweet moment. And and the Cassandra character, I think, is a little problematic. She's not as nearly as fully fleshed out as the other characters are. She's kind of more of a purely comic figure in the play. I guess I didn't interpret that quite in such terms of color, but mm-hmm. of race. But that's something to think about for sure, because she's, every time she's on stage, she's sort of, a volcano. We don't learn more about her, inner, what's really going on inside her. So I don't know, maybe that's something that, is a weak point. I don't know that, it's a play that really even seems to try to grapple with, the outsider or people who are, of different backgrounds outside of this little, sort of hermetically sealed family unit.
Well, it's interesting. I would say that reading the play on the page, I was surprised at how much Cassandra, she's described as possibly African American. I think she doesn't need to be, and the lines don't read in the way that I think I know what you mean, Wendy, that they might play.
She was not played by an African American in our production.
Okay.
The young lady played here is of Philippine heritage, actually, and she used an accent that was sort of vaguely Latin or Hispanic or possibly Caribbean. You really couldn't tell exactly what her heritage was supposed to be, but she was a person who was in touch with various things like voodoo.
Right. I do think that I would push you on the one outsider that I really do feel doesn't get much sympathy, and he has antecedents in some of Durang's work. I think of Betty's Summer Vacation, some of the young boy toys in that, is Spike. Spike, his name sticks out in the title, and he really is the emissary from, as you say, Wendy, the younger generation, texting all the time. And I think Vanya's speech might resonate with certain members of the audience because it's directed at that young, clueless, rude, young guy. Did he come off as charming in the various productions you saw? Or would he come off as a completely someone you write off?
The actor that I saw was fairly charming. But again, in that monologue, he's a target. And I think he's an unfair. I mean, there are, there's always, a clueless boy toy that you can make fun of. But I feel that I just feel that Durang is making fun of him for the wrong reasons. That sort of anti-technology rant just seems sort of silly and makes Durang sound irrelevant. Twitter isn't this, it can be frivolous, but it's not always. So, Vanya sort of goes off about Twittering and tweeting. And I don't know, I just felt like he was sort of stabbing in the dark there.
Right.
I agree to some extent because Spike is certainly a stock character, the young boy toy of the older actress. Plus, he's a little bit of a hustler because he's flirting with Vanya as well, and then he's having his thing with Hootie Pie as well. I thought he was not the best target for the whole modern technology Twitter rant, given that that's not a big part of his character. His physique, his sexy looks, that's what his character's all about. And if you wanted to make some sort of attack or denouncement of the modern world, I would think you would need perhaps a Wall Street young executive or something, or a person who's heavily into technology. That would be a good target to skewer.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. I think we've touched on things that we'll bring up in the next. My next question would be, it's going to be one of the most produced plays this coming season. Do you have some thought about why you think this play has caught on and is going to be done so much? And do you think it has a future that's going to be done, our children's children will be doing this play? Or what do you think about the play's legs for the future?
I'll just jump in quickly. I not to be too much of a cynic, but I think often these plays are chosen because it's a relatively small cast. Regional theaters, are, generally speaking, aren't swimming in money. So, it's a proven kind of a crowd pleaser that can be done, relatively economically. But also I think there is the fact that Christopher Durang is somewhat well known to at least to, you know, frequent playgoers. So it's got that brand name attached to it. And, you know, and you've got to, most theaters around town try to mix it up with, you know, plenty of comedies along with, the dramas and everything else. So, so it, you know, kind of, probably slots in well to a lot of theater seasons, but you know, that's not to dismiss the, what I think is the quality of the piece. I think it's going to be, I think it may prove to be a difficult one to produce, more difficult than a lot of directors and artistic directors might think, to get it right. But, we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, I'll put, ask you real quick, Jim, since you saw it on Broadway and Old Globe, one thing that struck me about why it works so well on Broadway was I felt it was so linked to the performers who did it there. But there also, I thought there are types of actors who could do this, and there's a Masha in every community, right? there's a Sonia, there's actors of that age, and then there's, but yeah, because you could talk about that, maybe comparing them, and then I'll ask.
Well, just commenting on one part of what you said about the original cast, I think there was a funny cachet that comes with a play that originally had a bunch of stars in it.
Right.
It's kind of the same thing a little bit with I don't know what kind of language we can use on this program. I'm just going to say the mofo with the hat, you know, which starred Chris Rock. And so it's kind of like when regional theaters pitch that to their audiences, they can say, yeah, this is the Chris Rock play you might have heard about, where the play that Chris Rock was in, it sort of identifies it in people's minds. And there's a little bit of a, I think, the same thing here with, you know, here's, you can check out the play that Sigourney Weaver starred in on Broadway. And,
yeah.
Okay. And again, you know, maybe that's being a little bit cynical. I don't want to talk too much about the whole marketing side of it, but I think there is that, certainly that factor involved.
Sure, sure.
I think the marketing side of it has an awful lot to do with it, though. As you said, a small cast, costumes are simple, one simple set, and roles for actors over 40 or 50, and those are hard to come by, so that makes it attractive anywhere. Also, the fact that it's a Tony winner. That's the way a lot of shows, especially small cast shows, Clive and Park, Venus and Fur, the mofo with the hat, small cast shows. These were all done here in town by the same theater that did this show. And also, I think a lot of it will depend in future years on how Durang's reputation holds up. If 50 years from now he's seen as one of the giants of the 20th and early 21st century, then his shows will be done again and again. If he's sort of forgotten as a you know, quirky person who did a few cute things, then they won't be.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Beyond Therapy is still done. Actor's Nightmare is still done 30 years later.
Yeah,
it's true. Beyond Therapy was, I think until now, was his most produced play, but this might give it a run for his money. Wendy, you were going to chime in.
I think that, I mean, it's smart and it's funny and... I think as sort of a the sunset of the baby boomer, you know, the play that represented that. I think, you know, it could last in that way. It has its problems, but and that, you know, the roles for older actors. That's a great point. That the actress who played Masha here in Philadelphia, you know, in a regional theater setting where there's a homegrown theater community. You know, it's great to see performers take that on and sort of run with it. So I can understand why it's popular. I just think that the reasons that it is so popular are also a concern.
Right, sure. I do think maybe this is speaking from the New York and Broadway perspective, but it does seem like there's a dearth of really good comedies. And that it really became a, there's a show now, It's Only a Play, that is selling really well, not just because Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick are in it, but because it's a comedy and it's got a bunch of stars in it. And it's because it's a comedy, that's what's been emphasized so much. And I feel like I would venture to say that has a lot to do with it being a relatively small cast. It's not like Venus and Fur, two people. It's six people, right? Six, I think. It's a comedy, but it's also warm. I think maybe the biggest surprise about it for me was how warm of a play it was. And Durang is someone who in previous plays is maybe not known for his warmth towards his characters or sending us out on a happy note. I think he said in interviews before that it surprised him how happy this play turned out to be.
I do think, yeah, too, there's an element of, people of, I mean, it does kind of encourage people to identify with these characters, boomer era audiences to identify with these characters. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit of a streak of self-mockery. There's a line, and I'm trying to remember exactly how the scene goes, but I think it's, they're reading the play that Vanya has written where,
yeah,
they've died or they're in space or something. So the character that Sonia is reading says something like, they're talking about the things they miss from being on Earth. And she says, well, I miss self-pity. And I think it's sort of a nod to the fact that these are such, self-absorbed, incredibly self-absorbed people who are kind of wallowing in their problems to some extent. And maybe it's a chance for the audience to sort of look at themselves and say, yeah, I'm taking myself a little too seriously.
Right. I think we've covered everything, and I really enjoyed the conversation. And I hope we can do this again when another of these nationally ratified shows comes to your town again.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, all
Thanks.
Of you. Thanks for taking the time.
Bye-bye.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye now. Welcome back. Those are two interesting features. Just stealing a page from Slate's Culture Gabfest and the other Gabfests, I thought it'd be fun to recommend things that we've seen, read, watched, that we thought people should know about. Let me start with you, Deep. You just went to the Philly Fringe.
Yes, I just went to Philadelphia, where I've never been before, and I didn't know it was that easy to get there. Then again, I've only been here 3 years, but it's about an hour and a half away from New York City, and the Philly Fringe just rebranded themselves. They're now Fringe Arts.
Okay.
Philadelphia Fringe Arts Festival, and they just had, and they have a new kind of hub that kind of looks like an old firehouse / Bushwick loft with exposed brick, and there's a restaurant. And I want to recommend the Beer Garden because I support anywhere that has theater and booze.
And brings the two together.
Exactly.
It's a happy marriage.
Yes.
So the Fringe is over, so people can't go see that. Some of the shows that came out of it might move on. You said 99 Breakups might come some?
I can't imagine why. It's Pig Iron.
And right, sure.
So they need to come to New York at some point. I feel like it's in their contract at this point, but they just have to find a museum because it was really interesting. I can't remember. Wait, let me look at it.
Was it a museum?
It was at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, which is like a little bit north, like half a block away from City Hall. And it was this huge, like sprawling gallery space. And so it was like a little docent tour of different breakup scenes.
Oh, wow.
So they set up a bed in one of the galleries, and one of the characters was mimicking like the pose that was in one of the paintings. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and I feel like if they can find a great gallery in New York City that can accommodate them, then I would recommend that for anyone who's interested in immersive theater / art tours.
Or it could move to a gallery in a different city.
Exactly.
It's something
that's
that
true.
Could travel or tour. So. Not just New York.
Exactly.
So this idea of doing theater museums sounds interesting. Is someone working on a story about that, perhaps?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for plugging my work, Rob.
That'll be in the November issue, right? Or no?
It'll be sometime this spring. I think
okay.
that might be time
oh,
to get
the spring.
To the civilians.
The civilians at the Met.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Who I'm very excited about. And also, if anyone wants to see the Rimini Protocol show next time it's coming to your city, they did 100% Philadelphia in... at Philly, and it's kind of an iteration of things that they've been doing in different cities, like taking citizens and then whittling them down.
So they could do it at other cities, right?
Exactly. They did it at La Jolla. I think they did it in New York. So if they're ever coming to your city, they're a German company. So check it out and, get involved in your community.
Sounds good. Susie, you just saw something you really liked.
Yeah, I saw the Bridget Everett show Rock Bottom at Joe's Pub. And now I've been hearing about Bridget Everett for a while from friends and had seen some videos on YouTube, heard that she, sang with Patti LuPone once at Carnegie Hall. And so I was very intrigued. I saw her show at Joe's Pub, and it was an experience. It was very good. I mean, watch some videos on YouTube. just to get an idea of what you're in for. But it's quite an evening. It's got some songs by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman, who are, you know, Tony-winning musical theater writers. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I'd say if you can see Bridget Everett, I know she did a show up at Oberon and ART a few weeks ago. So she tours. She's doing a show at Joe's Pub right now. And if you can't get to her, there's a YouTube spiral waiting for you.
What's it about, her show at Joe's Pub?
Well, I don't know what we're rating this podcast, but it's definitely about her sexual escapades and her love of Chardonnay.
Right. Okay.
Oh man, I saw something similar when I was in Philly. That was also about sexual escapades, but I think that was a little bit more R-rated than Bridget Everett.
Let's just say she doesn't support wearing a bra, and she likes to sing about what I just mentioned.
So sex, wine, and rock and roll, you could say.
Let's just say that there was a very prominent actor in the audience who may have licked whipped cream off of her inner thigh in the middle of the performance.
Wait, is that something we can expect every night? Or just changes?
Can expect it every night, but you can't expect that Andre DeShields will be doing it every night.
Oh, Andre DeShields.
Oh,
wow.
Wow.
My recommendation is a little out of left field. I'll keep it as brief as I can. John Doyle is going to direct Allegro, which is the...
The Rodgers and Hammerstein music.
Rodgers and Hammerstein, like one of their only non-hits. The show that Stephen Sondheim sort of jokingly, he saw it when he was a teenager and said he's been trying to fix Allegro ever since. Just alluding to the fact that he's been trying to do the kind of experimental work that Hammerstein was trying to do there in his work ever since. Hugely influential show. What I want to recommend is a DVD of a Brecht Weil opera called The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. At the LA Opera. It had Audra McDonald and Patti LuPone and some great opera singers who I should know their names, but I don't. I recommend it only because John Doyle has a rep in New York, a punchline that he's the guy with the musical instruments because of Sweeney Todd and company. But I think that sells his directorial style and vision short. If you want to see... I don't know what he's doing with Allegro. There's no musicians playing, no actors playing instruments in that show. But if you want to see like one of the great 20th century works done with his sort of stripped down, stark, I would say Brechtian aesthetic, check out the DVD of The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, especially because Audra McDonald is amazing in it, if for nothing else. But also to see that John Doyle is more than just, you know, people playing saxophones and singing. So my recommendation.
Well, he just did Passion like a year, last year at... Classic Stage Company.
And nobody was playing instruments there.
No,
yeah, I think it's an unfair rap.
I mean, Allegro was at Classic Stage too. And he just did The Visit up at Williamstown too, which I heard was good that I didn't get to see.
I mean, you can argue with his aesthetic on other grounds if you want, but in any case, I think that's probably the best thing I've seen him do, and I only saw the DVD, I didn't see it in person, but it's great. It's also probably Brecht and Weil's best work, better than Three Penny, better than Happy End. It's the real thing. So check that out if you can. I think it's on Amazon. Mm-hmm. All right. That wraps up our show. Thanks for doing this, and thanks for listening. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. I think there's also a page on our website you're reading this on.
Yep. And please come visit our website, www.americantheater.org, ERRE, however you want to spell theater. Please don't spell it wrong, though. That would be unfortunate.
And if you let us know, you know, things you want to hear about and things you're excited about, maybe we'll shout out on the podcast.
Sounds good. Yes. All right. Till next, the week after next.
Yes.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye. See you later.